Let me start by saying hello to everybody and almost goodbye. I'm only able to come out for a very short time, which I'm sorry about, but I'm pleased that I have the chance to talk with people out here a little bit. What I'm going to tell you about today is some theoretical work I'm interested in playing out the consequences of figuring out what it means to take the existence of force chains in a granular material seriously. And I'll tell you more what I mean by taking them seriously. And I want this talk to have the flavor of a discussion. At least, I'll get through half an hour or 40 minutes perhaps. But I want to be sure to leave time at the end, because I'd really like to hear from people who are working on the static granular materials from a variety of different contexts to see if we can pull together some ideas or identify some key experiments that should be done that will help disentangle some of the theoretical knots that seem to arise when you try to understand stress in dense granular materials. So I'm going to be talking about work. Is there a pointer here? No. Here's one. I'm going to be talking about work that started a couple of years ago when Philippe Claudin visited Duke University and first told us about work that he was doing with Jean-Philippe Bouchot and Dov Levine on thinking about a model of force chains and the networks that they might produce. That got us thinking, and since then, Jean-Philippe Bouchot and Philippe Claudin and David Schaefer, who's a mathematician at Duke, and I have been trying to push harder on this theoretical model to see if we can understand how it really behaves. We are motivated, to a large extent, by experimental work that's been done in Bob Berenger's lab and also in collaboration with Eric Clément at Jussieu and a number of their students. And this image is an image from Bob's lab, in which you see the black in this image represents stronger stresses on photoelastic particles, and I'll show you a little bit about the kinds of experiments that Bob can do just to sort of help us see what I mean by force chains and sort of how chainy the real systems really are. I'm sure you've all seen pictures like this before. The idea here is that this is a picture in which the grain size is, I don't know, between here and here is 3 or 4 grains. And you see that when you put these birefringent disks or pentagons between cross polarizers and light them from below and take a picture from above, only the, I'll show you the geometry of it. So the geometry is like this. You have two cross polarizers here. You put the disks in between, you shine light from the bottom, and only the light that has its polarization rotated as it comes through the disk will make it through the top. And so the disks are birefringent only under strain. So it's only the disks that are distorted a little bit or compressed a little bit that will light up. And that's what you're seeing in pictures like this. You're seeing which disks light up. Now what I want to do is...
Disks are, what you said before, said that the disks are much bigger than the spots that I'm seeing in this forest.
Yes, because the what really lights up is the pattern of stress on the disk. And so what really lights up most is the region close to a contact between disks, where the distortions, where the strains are largest. And so what you're really seeing here Well, Steve may be better on other pictures, but I don't know if you can really tell. In some places here where it looks like there are two disks, that's really just two contacts on the same disk. Now, the picture has a chainy look to it, and there's a big mystery. What we'd really like to do is start with some statistical modeling, perhaps, or some understanding of what goes on at the grain scale, and derive from that a macroscopic theory for the stresses, you know, on a scale of the whole picture. And the question is, what kind of constitutive relations do you need to close the system of stress equilibrium equations? How do you understand the boundary conditions on those equations? What kind of equations will they be? Will they turn out to be elliptic equations of the type that are familiar from standard elasticity theory? Or will they turn out to be hyperbolic equations in which suggests that stress propagates in a wave-like manner along characteristic directions in the system? Now, if you try to imagine going from the grain scale right up to the macroscopic scale, this picture, at least to me, suggests that you're going to run into trouble, because there's clearly something happening at an intermediate scale that may be quite difficult to capture. And so what I'm going to pursue is the idea that we can think of this system as, on a mesoscopic scale, if you like, as a set of chains, elastic chains, or what I'll call force chains, that interact with each other in some way. So instead of going directly from the grains to the macroscopic, we have to make a stop at this intermediate level. And that means that we have really two kinds of problems to solve. One is, where do the chains come from in the first place? How do you get from grains to chains? And the other is, once you have chains, how does their presence influence the macroscopic stress? I am going to completely ignore the first step for the purposes of this talk. I have no idea where the chains come from, why they're there. Presumably, when you shear this system or compress it a little bit or make the particles move around, there's a process of some sort of organization that's very subtle, where particles are responding to the stresses on them, moving around a little bit, forming contacts in ways that lead eventually to the formation of these chains. What I'm going to play out for you a little bit is the to show you how we develop a theory if we take the chains to be the physical entities that are the fundamental objects in the model, and ask, how do the chains interact and what consequences does that have? So again, just some pictures from the lab, just so you can see what this chain-like structure does, and if you haven't seen these before, get an idea of what you're seeing here. So this is the system without the cross-polarizers in place. This is the exact same system with the polarizers in place, so that you only see the particles that are under stress.
Is it actually synchronized? Are these really the same pictures? It doesn't actually look like
I think yeah. So.
So they're done with two cameras running at the same time.
It's not completely in registry, though, because this is...
No, these are... let's see. Is it bomb?
There's not a direct mapping of those images.
Well, so you want to tell us what the lines are on the right-hand side?
They're just literally lines drawn on the particles, so you can tell whether they're rotating.
Not on the... Okay.
Yeah.
And then on the left-hand side, if it's moving, what are you doing as it moves?
So these are particles in a Couette geometry.
Yeah.
You're shearing the inner wheel just to go. Here's a slightly bigger picture so you can see more of the chain-like structure. And you see these chains move around in a very jerky way. It's not like there's a smooth evolution of change. They pop in and out of existence as particles near the inner wheel move into new positions. There's hardly any motion of the particles out here. In this intermediate region here, the particles aren't moving much. It's just that different stress chains are getting lit up. Here's another example of an experimental system in which you're moving this whole annulus past an obstacle here. Actually, you're dragging. Are you dragging the obstacle?
Yeah. No, you said it right the first time.
Right.
There's an annulus. The particles are sliding past.
Right. And there's an obstacle here, and the particles have to sort of adjust their positions to get around it. And again, Again, the point is that the stress does not distribute itself in any kind of homogeneous fashion back here. It really jumps around from chain to chain.
So when we look at these, do we see all of the forces, or are there some that are small enough that, so they don't light up?
Well, that depends. That's a very good question, actually. It depends on, let's see, there are a number of issues associated with interpreting the optical image here. So the optical image, of course, is highly nonlinear. It's not so easy to judge exactly what the strength of the force chains are based on how much light you see. But when Bob does the experiments, he's carefully figured out how to calibrate, do the image analysis and calibrate things so that he can measure the forces.
So we're looking at something that's calibrated to a linear scale.
No, I think this is the raw image.
That's how it comes out.
Yeah.
There's no problem that there might be some grains that have stresses, but the stresses are lined up in the wrong way to be picked up by the cross polarized.
The polarization, it's on the circular polarization. It's a little bit more complicated than I suggested. So you don't have this, it's all so isotropic.
Okay, and so
yeah.
And any rotation will get picked up.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe I should give a mini seminar talk sometime on how this works, so, rather than picking on John.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, I don't mind. What I want to tell you about a little bit is how we've developed a theory of these networks of force chains, just because, partly because there's one result we have. We have one exactly solvable model that produces an interesting result. And then also because when we try to generalize to a more generic case, we run into some serious mathematical difficulties, and I just want to sort of take you up to that point so that if anybody has some ideas for me, you can tell me how to proceed. But here's the model. We're going to assume that the entities we're trying to describe are linear chains of some indeterminate length. The chains are injected into the system at the boundaries, and so you imagine a packing of grains somehow. I'm just using this hexagonal packing as a sort of schematic way of introducing the concepts here. Don't take this picture too seriously. If you actually put hexagonal grains together like this and push, you won't see exactly this configuration. But the idea is that if I push, so imagine I sort of poke a needle through the boundary here and push on this particle, I'll generate a force chain that propagates down to this boundary. If I were to push over here, I might generate another force chain that propagates down. Now these force chains, of course, carry only compressive stresses. You can't pull on a force chain. Doesn't support tensile stress. So each force chain is going to be characterized by a strength, F, and a direction, theta. Now, this, the direction theta, you might at first think is indeterminate. That is, theta plus pi, it looks perhaps like it's the same as theta. But I want to suggest, and the theory sort of forces us to assign a direction to this chain, and the direction is determined by the boundary condition. So it's pushing here and pushing here, that is, setting force boundary conditions here and here is different from, say, pushing here and pushing here. And you can, in a system like this, you can sort of intuitively see why it might be different. If I push here and here, that means this force has to exist up here. This one has to exist here. They might pass through each other, or something else might happen when they cross. But for example, if instead of pushing on this chain from here, I were to push from here, then it's quite possible that I would get a different solution. So this chain here has a direction to it that's determined by the boundary condition on the chain. We call this kind of event where two force chains join a fusion event. And it's also possible to have what's called a splitting event. So imagine in this system that there's some defect here, some reason that this chain can't propagate all the way to the boundary. When it reaches this point, it has to split somehow in such a way that force balance is preserved on this grain here.
Is there really any difference between the direction?
Between...
Well, okay, you have the arrow. So you have an arrow on the line. Mm-hmm. You reverse the arrow, so it's all the same. It's a compressive stress, it doesn't have a direction. Well, it has a direction, but it can't
Well,
get away.
So what the arrow is telling you about is the boundary conditions on the system. Right? So in this case, I'm insisting that there be a force here and a force here. In this case, I'm insisting there be a force here and a force here. And you don't, so flipping this arrow to here does not necessarily reproduce the same configuration.
Well, the statics, of course, require a balance of forces, which in principle you could have set up as the initial condition, which would then be satisfied by these two arrows. So you could, in principle, reverse everything.
Being a static.
Well,
you have to be a little careful. So even in an elastic theory,
I admit that boundary conditions might be strange, but it is reversible in that sense.
Let's be a little careful. I'm not sure the sense in which it's reversible. I'm not sure whether that's it's meaningful, right? So think of, say, an elastic system. If I push on the top, I'm applying a stress boundary condition at the top, and I assume, for example, typically that I have a zero displacement at the bottom.
Which means there's a stress.
Which means there's a stress there. Right, but if I reverse it, what would it mean to do to reverse everything? It would mean you apply a stress boundary condition at the bottom, and then what at the top? Zero displacement?
Well, you still, in a sense, would have to extract the force, if you like, from one point at the other end, but it would all reverse, in principle. It's probably not a very practical point.
Yeah.
But the arrows,
I mean, you'd have to very carefully set everything up, right?
And Bob's pictures they beautifully show this splitting, mm-hmm. and a clear sort of breaking of that symmetry. But I still find that you should be able to reverse everything.
It's true.
A static solution that has everything reversed.
Yes, that's correct. Let's just save that this point for a little while and come back to it, because I think that's one of the central issues in this business is whether systems are hyperstatic or isostatic, and when you try to describe, for example, hyperstatic systems in terms of simple boundary conditions and elastic theory, how do you decide which configurations you're going to see? And how do the micro displacements, for example, of these disks lead to transmission of forces which might be different depending on whether you chose this boundary condition or this one? Okay, so how do we set up a theory to deal with this? Well, we're going to write down the simplest mean field type theory that we can think of and see if we can solve it and learn anything from it. So what would be the variables in this theory? It would be the densities of the force chains in all the different directions. So we imagine a picture like this. I choose some line, some direction in the sample, or some plane with normal n, and I ask, what is the density of force chains in that direction crossing that line? And so at each point in space, I'll have a density of chains in each direction. And what I want to write down is a theory that describes how those densities vary in space. It's once you have the chain densities, it's easy to convert that to a stress field. Now, how do you put in, where do the material properties of the system enter the theory? They're going to enter in two different functions. One is a function that tells me how chains split, how often it happens that a chain that's injected in at one position splits into two chains, and there's going to be a parameter lambda, a length that tells me typically how far a force chain goes before it encounters a region where it has to split. And then when it does split, there's going to be a function that tells me what's the probability that it will split into two force chains at particular angles. So here's an incoming force chain to a vertex, and it splits into two outgoing chains. And there's a function that tells me what the probability is for F1 and F2 to come out.
Does it have to be two?
It doesn't have to be two, but we're
the assumption.
So the philosophy behind this approach is the thing is going to be complicated enough. Let's make it, strip it down as much as we have to in order to actually be able to solve something. And, you know, hopefully with Einstein in mind, we don't want to strip it down more than we actually can. The other thing that can happen is that two force chains coming into a vertex can fuse so that one comes out. And there's a parameter associated with that. This parameter y tells me roughly what's the probability that two force chains that intersect will actually fuse rather than just cross right through each other. The physics of splitting and fusing are very different, right? Splitting happens when a chain just can't propagate through. There's some defect in the system, or whatever the geometry of particles doesn't allow a chain to propagate through. Fusion can happen even in regions where if you tried to reverse it, you would see no reason for splitting to occur.
I just have a question about the expression of the stress. F appears boldface and then scalar.
So boldface means the vector F, means little f times the vector m.
I don't want to go back to the point you were discussing earlier too much, but this all has this implicit directionality
and
hyperbolicity built into it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You can see a simpler model where these things would there be no distinction between splitting and fusing? You've got arguments.
You can conceive of a model, well, let's see. You can conceive of the possibility of a model like that. It doesn't turn out to be any simpler to write it down or work with it. It turns out, for example, that this fusion function actually has different dimensions than the splitting function. And so, they really are physically different things, and it's not, we haven't been able to write down a theory in which we impose, which we can impose the symmetry that you're talking about. If you had a way of doing that, we'd be quite interested. So let me show you why the dimensions are different. So here is the theory that we write down. This is a Boltzmann-like equation that tells me how the densities of chains are varying in space. And the equation we write down tells us if I'm sitting on a force chain in the direction n, and I move along that direction, what happens to that chain? So there's a probability that it will split, and probabilities it will fuse, and we get an equation with these various terms in it. So the first term, so what we're asking is, if we know we have a force chain here, what's the probability that when we go a little bit farther, we'll still have a force chain in that same direction? And there are two contributions to this that come from splitting events. So there's a probability that the chain will split, in which case we won't have it anymore. So P of F will decrease. That's this negative contribution. There's also a probability that some chain coming from another direction will split and create a chain in this direction. And that's the second term there. So those two terms are both linear in the chain densities. And represent the effects of splitting. The second two terms represent the effects of fusion. So there's a negative term which comes from the fact that a fusion event can knock this chain into a different direction. And there's a positive term that comes from a fusion event which creates a new chain in this direction. So what we're writing down here now is a mean field theory for the density of chains. What we have to do is solve this equation for all the P of F simultaneously. Okay, so just quickly, I don't want to dwell on this, but these fusion functions or splitting functions we're going to assume that they are isotropic in the sense that that a chain propagating in this direction is just as likely to split in a given distance as a chain propagating in another direction. And when they do split, the angles that they split into can only depend on the difference between the new angles and the old one. They don't depend on any absolute direction. So this is a sort of typical form. This delta function ensures that the forces are balanced at the vertex. There's a Heaviside step function in each of the Fs, which just says the Fs always have to be positive. That means the stresses are always compressive. There's a geometric factor here that we like to put in explicitly that just says if a chain splits, for example, it can't split into two chains that go in the very same direction. And then there's some function which is characteristic of the material. Now, the interesting thing that makes this problem both difficult and mathematically intriguing is that your first inclination would be to just ignore these two terms. Imagine that the density of chains is small, and so we can ignore the terms that are quadratic in the densities and deal with just the linear theory. But it turns out that linear theory is divergent, that the state in which P of F is equal to zero for all chains, or for all directions, is an unstable solution to the equations. As soon as you inject a chain, it starts splitting and generating lots more chains, and if you never allow those chains to fuse, they just keep splitting over and over and over again and generating infinite density of chains.
But that must relate to the boundary conditions in a sense, though. You can't have a force loop inside because, so if you had zero stress as your boundary condition, the solution would have to be zero stress inside.
If you had zero stress on the boundary, so if you were not injecting any chains, then okay, but as soon as you try to inject any chain in, you can't. Let's be careful. If the system is small enough, the chain could just propagate to the other boundary and you'd be done. But if the system is large enough, sort of larger than the persistence length of a chain, so that the chain can sort of turn around and if loops can form, when the system gets that big, then you see that the theory becomes divergent. And I can make that much more mathematically precise for you in a moment when we look at the exactly solvable case. And I'll just mention, without loss of generality, for mathematical purposes, you can set y and lambda both equal to 1 by rescaling the length in the system and the variables p. Okay, so what's this solvable case? So I'm going to just take some time here to try to describe to you what happens in the one case that we really understand. We're going to look at a system in which the force chains are confined to lie on a hexagonal set of directions. Now that has a number of implications which make the problem solvable, and you'll see it involves a lot of simplification, but even with all that, the answer is has some subtleties to it. We can choose, so what I'm going to imagine is a sort of slab geometry where we have an infinitely wide slab in the x direction, and we're going to be injecting chains at the top and perhaps at the bottom also, and trying to understand what the density of chains in the various directions is as we move down through the slab. When I do that, I can choose to orient my hexagonal set of directions in two different ways. We've done both of them, but I'll start by talking about this one because that's where you can do the most, get the farthest analytically. So what happens now is that function P of F, now I've got a discrete set of thetas. So it becomes a set of six, that partial differential equation, the Boltzmann equation that I wrote before, becomes a set of six coupled ordinary differential equations. Hexagonal symmetry is special because when two chains split, they split at a 120 degree angle, and in order for the force to remain balanced, it has to be that the strengths of the chains that split off are exactly equal to the chain that came in. So that provides a tremendous simplification here because I don't have a set of different Fs anymore. All the chains in my system are going to have the same strength. So I really just have six P's to work with. Now, I'll simplify things even further. So here are the equations for the six different P's. I'll simplify things even further by assuming a mirror symmetry about this line here. So I will assume that the injected chains are, that the density of injected ones is the same as the density of injected zeros, so that P1 will will be equal to P0, and P3 will be equal to P4, P2 will be equal to P5, so I'll reduce this set of six ordinary differential equations to three. Then it will turn out that I can go even one step further. In this geometry, it turns out that P2 and P5 can be expressed because the cosine theta associated with them is zero. I wind up with that. The equations for 2 and 5 are not differential equations at all. They're just algebraic equations that I can solve in terms of the P1 and P3. And so in the end, I just get two coupled differential equations for P1 and P3 that I can analyze. And what happens is that the fixed point of those equations with P1 and P3 both equal to zero is unstable. But what you find is that there is a line of stable fixed points, and this line represents possible homogeneous configurations of the system. So if I set the left-hand side here to zero, any one of these points indicates a homogeneous solution for the stresses. In this picture, if you think of the z direction as time, then when you determine your boundary condition, so suppose I say that I'm going to inject some density of chains in this direction at the top of the system, I can choose, say, P1 and P3. That will put me at a point in this picture, and I can ask, as we go down in z, or as time progresses, where does that point flow? And these arrows show you the directions of the flow. They have to be along the lines P1 plus P3 equal constant, because the z component, sigma zz, integrated over the system, has to stay constant as you go down. Yeah.
Josh, so is your diagram also saying that aside from zero being unstable, that there's actually a finite threshold below which you cannot sustain, the model does not sustain the stress?
Tension
point right there.
Here?
That's right. So between there and the one and zero, I guess. So your model would not have the possibility that the material could actually have a finite stress below that?
Let's be careful. Let's not conflate two different things. So the one issue is, what is the density of force change in the system? The other question is, how strong are they? So by adjusting F, I could take the same network of force chains and make it as weak, make it correspond to as weak a stress as I want. So I haven't, there's an overall scaling of all the forces here. So I'm not sure exactly. What it is saying is that if the system is deep enough, there's going to be a finite density of chains. You can't have an arbitrarily low density of chains. But they can be weak. Yeah.
I think maybe this is the same question, essentially, but that first arrow you have, in the lower left corner, physically, what does that correspond to? It looks like it flows to finite P1 with zero P3, and that sounds to me like a stable physical solution.
Right. Here's the problem. Here's the problem. You ask, how long does it take to get here? Mm-hmm. And what you'll find is that it gets here in a finite time. That means at finite z. So if I were to choose an initial point here, for example, if the system is shallow enough, then I can just flow to another point here and there's no problem. But if the system gets deep, then I will wind up flowing to negative values of P3. And of course, the chain density can't really be negative, but what that's an indication of is the fact that there's a divergence in the system, and something's becoming infinite here. It's like, when you sum a geometric series and you get 1 over 1 minus r. When r gets bigger than 1, you get a negative answer, but what it's really telling you is that things diverge.
Okay, so that axis is not stable.
So I want to make a sort of, there's a more interesting statement than that to make. What this is telling you is that you can't just arbitrarily choose P3 and P1 on some boundary and propagate down and see what you get. Things will diverge if you try to do that. What you can always do is choose P1 at the top boundary and P3 at the bottom boundary. So what you can always do, that mathematically I won't bother to prove it for you here, but you can choose an arbitrary value for the density of injected chains from the top, ingoing chains, and you can choose an arbitrary value for the density of ingoing chains at the bottom, but you have to let the outgoing chains just be whatever they're going to be. So what happens here, for example, if I make the system really deep, I can start near one of these fixed points. So for example, suppose I say that P1 on the top boundary has this value, and P3 on the bottom boundary is symmetric, for example. Then I will be moving along this line as I go through the system. The density of chains pointing downward will be decreasing. The density of chains pointing upward will be increasing. And if I make the system deeper and deeper, I'll have to start closer and closer to these fixed points to get this to happen in the right amount of time. It's like a two-point boundary value problem. And the mathematics of this model tells you you have to treat it as a two-point boundary value problem. You can't try to specify P1 and P3 both at the top. Sometimes it'll work, but sometimes it won't. And this path here corresponds to densities of chains that look like this. So when you're near the top, you have a small density of chains in the 3 direction and 4. When you're and a large density in the 1 direction. And then somewhere in the middle, you're going to make a transition. So you're going to be sitting here for a long, long time. And then somewhere in the middle, you're going to travel this path and then sit here for a long time. A sort of curious thing that comes out of this is I can compute the sigma ZZ component of stress has to just stay constant as I go through the system. That's a conservation law. But sigma XX can do whatever it wants. And in this particular case, it does something sort of interesting. There's a bump in the middle. And that comes from the fact that you have a bunch of chains schematically coming down like this and a bunch going up like this. And somehow they have to meet up with each other, which means there have to be these a structure sort of like this somewhere in the middle, at least statistically, so that there's no sigma xx up here and none down here, but there's got to be some in the middle for things to match up. Yeah.
Maybe there's an important point here, because if you write down the convention Boltzmann equation, you come to a point where you have to consider the conservation of momentum and the conservation of energy. This is done by the collision operator.
Right.
In your case, it's more a rate equation for
chemical rate equation.
But therefore, I expect that you have a condition that looks like more the Kirchhoff-like law. I think the force go in has to do something with the force go out.
Right.
Where it is considered. The next equation.
Well,
the question is we have boundary conditions, but you're not free to apply boundary conditions.
Yeah.
If you apply your boundary conditions unbalanced, then
stress is
removed.
No. Be careful. Let's see. So I can have a chain here, for example, that comes down here and splits and does this and goes back up. So the total stress on the top boundary is not necessarily determined just by the boundary condition I apply. There's a response to that that generates additional stress.
Okay, but
and same on the bottom.
I want to say you're not free to apply simply stress somewhere in the boundary. You have to apply the
you mean I have to put, well, let me just say yes, I agree with that. I agree with that, you're not free, but the sense in which that doesn't constrain you to pick particular values of P1 and P3, because you can make up for it by, for example, at the top boundary where I'm specifying P1, I can make up additional stress by having a solution in which P3, in which there's a non-zero P3 at the boundary.
No, but this is a global constraint. This is a global constraint. You have all the local constraints. Maybe sort of Kirchhoff-like equations. And each one you have to assure that the incoming forces...
Oh yeah, that was included in the model. That was included in that splitting function. And in the hexagonal case, every force, it is true that every chain here has the same strength. So that guarantees force balance at every vertex.
Isn't P3 a tensile stress at the top?
Sorry?
Isn't P3 tensile?
No. It's just a compressive chain in which the boundary conditions dictate that it's going that way rather than that way. And so imagine I have a box of sand or whatever with no gravity, and I have a top on it. If I inject a little needle through and push down on one grain, it may cause other grains somewhere else on the boundary to get pushed up into the top. So those would be grains that where the boundary conditions say that those chains are being pushed up. I didn't impose them from outside. I just held the bar there. And by pushing down, I generated some additional stress on the top boundary. Okay, let me just get to the punchline here because it's taking a little bit longer than I thought. What we can do is sit on one of these fixed points. So now I'm imagining that you're just sitting that the entire system is in, say, this region where P1 has some value, P3 has some value, and ask, if I now apply a local additional force, if I inject one more chain at the top, what will the response of the system be? And so now I'm linearizing about that, about one of those fixed points and asking for the linear response. And what I see is something rather amusing. It turns out to be a little bit more interesting to look at it when the system is oriented with the hexagon this way. So it's not identical. It's not identical to the picture I showed you just before. But what happens is when I push up here, the response at shallow depths looks like a typical single peak response that you would expect in an elastic material. So there's one peak. These are contours of sigma zz as I go down through the system. But as I get to greater depths in the system, there's a crossover from that single peak response to what we can calculate at long distances really is a hyperbolic-like response. The widths of these peaks here are growing only diffusively with the depth. So it's not an anisotropic elastic material in which the widths, in which everything would scale linearly. These things really are getting fractionally sharper the deeper you go. So in this particular model, with all the caveats about all the simplifications that I made, you see that it suggests that one wants to be extremely careful about interpreting interpreting experiments that show experiments on the response function of these of a granular material at shallow depths, and shallow here means the persistence length of a force chain. If you don't go deep enough into the system to have the force chains looping around and splitting enough to see this divergence, then everything looks very simple and you just get a single peak below the place where you push. But once you go deep enough that the full physics of these force chains splitting and fusing come into play, in this particular model anyway, the nature of the response changes dramatically and you get something that looks hyperbolic.
How does this depend on the orientation of your coordinate system? I mean, if we rotate by 30 degrees, we get the same result?
Yes, you get the same result if you rotate it by 30 degrees with some technical differences. In this case, for the orientation I showed you here, the direction that this characteristic propagates is not one of the hexagonal directions. In fact, the direction varies continuously depending on which fixed point I choose to linearize around. So this fixed point corresponds to an isotropic state. The farther I go out this way, the more anisotropic the stress state is becoming. And as I move out this way, the angle at which the characteristics propagate varies continuously. It turns out that if I rotate that hexagon 30 degrees, this thing gets locked to a lattice direction. That's what the math says. I don't want to hold you over, so I'll just say this very quickly. We've tried to relax this assumption that things have to be on hexagonal directions, and things we made a fair amount of progress, but we got stuck. So what you can do is that there are certain sum rules that have to be met. You can then make your favorite choice for what these splitting and fusion functions are and see whether you get, see if you can even find homogeneous solutions to the equation, so homogeneous stress states. Choosing the splitting function is no big deal. You can choose whatever you want. We thought maybe a simple one would just be to say that the chain with strength F is equally likely to split into two chains with strength F prime and F double prime as long as F prime and F double prime lie in this triangle, for example. We tried making the same choice for the fusion function, and it turns out that things blow up. And what we found is that the only way to keep the density of chains finite is to allow fusions to occur much more easily than you would expect. So this is another indication that there is the mathematics is telling you that there's something very different about fusion than about splitting. They enter the theory in very different ways, and in order to keep chain densities finite, you have to assume a very different form for the fusion function than the splitting. And when you make those assumptions, now we're being very modest. All we're asking for is a homogeneous solution to that Boltzmann equation that I wrote down. So the gradients are gone. All I want is constant values of the p's. And it turns out that this is the equation that I have to solve for p of f, where f is the chain strength. I've also made an assumption that I'm looking for an isotropic solution, so there's no direction associated with f anymore. We wind up with this equation to solve, We can do the asymptotics at small forces and large forces, although this looks like it might be divergent, don't forget we're in two dimensions, and so when you integrate this over df squared, it's not divergent. At large forces, we get this exponential power law prefactor, but we have not been able. So the natural question is then, if you know the asymptotics at small f and large f, why don't you just put this thing on a computer and see what it looks like in between? And we've just run into all kinds of trouble trying to do that. We can't get the numerics to converge. I've asked, so Dave Schaefer is a mathematician in physics at Duke. I've asked, he suggested names of experts that I should ask about this problem. We ask the experts, and we get answers like, are you sure that a solution exists? So I don't know how to answer that question. But this is, that's the kind of help we've gotten from the mathematicians. It could be that maybe there's another solution that we're missing and that this asymptotic, that small f, doesn't match up with this, but there are more than one solution and we're just not finding them. But whenever we try to get a numerical solution of this equation using these asymptotics, the thing just doesn't converge. So if anybody has ideas about how to do that, I would be very interested. I think it's getting late, so I'm not going to go through the whole thing here. Here are some references, some papers that we've written on this topic. I have 20 minutes more stuff to talk about if you want, but I think that would be a little cruel, so I'll stop now and we can, if somebody asks the right question, I'll launch into a 15-minute discussion. So thanks for your attention. Yeah?
A couple questions. One is about where you say things blow up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's really a problem in this system. In other words, as I understand the way you refer to things blowing up, it's where the density of chains blows up.
Right.
Is that actually a problem as long as the forces remain finite? That actually sounds to me like it might just be going to a continuum. In other words, that you're just getting continuous density of weak chains. I mean, is that necessarily a problem? That might actually just be a simple solution where it's continuum.
Yeah, so I have to be careful here. The problem crops up in two different ways. So it always remains true that sigma zz is conserved. So I mean, there's always, we don't violate the conservation law on the imposed stress. And there are cases in which the chain density diverges, but the force density does not. That is, you get a divergence of chains, but they're so weak that the force density does not. There are also cases in which the force density diverges. So in the example that I showed you here, these hexagonal systems, all of the chains have the same force. So when that blows up, it really blows up. It means the force density is blowing up.
So that's
that is a problem.
It's an infinite concentration of force along certain.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's, well, I mean, I'm not sure it's meaningful.
Yeah.
It's a weird kind of divergence that you clearly want to avoid.
I'll save the other question.
Uh-huh.
Talk about
okay.
It.
Yeah.
You take hexagonal with 6. I mean, did you try to get to infinity by 6, 12, 18?
Yeah. Well, you asked, so. There you go.
I want 30 seconds.
This was not the 15-minute question. I gotta find the right slide that I hid here. Here.
Because I expect you to immediately see that the hyperbolic thing goes away and it gets to something more.
And now what it gets to is not as simple as you might hope. I guess I have to unhide this slide. Yeah, so you could ask, for example, suppose I use 8 instead of 6. Then what happens is every time a chain splits, the force on the strength of this chain and this one is related to this one by a factor of the square root of 2. And then when this one splits, it's going to generate new ones related by a factor of the square root of 2. So that set of 6 equations that we had for the hexagonal case is going to turn into an infinite hierarchy of equations for p's with for densities of chains with different strengths. And you have to be a little bit careful because the weird thing that happens here, and there's a paper on this, that you can solve the homogeneous equation here, and we find that where m now is an index of how strong the chain is, so the strength f sub m is square root of 2 to the m, we can solve for, again, there's a set of homogeneous solutions that are anisotropic, right, with this form here. There's something weird about it, though, because when what's funny here, the splitting all sounds very reasonable. What's weird is the fusion, because now, in order for two chains to fuse, if you took a chain of arbitrary strength meeting another chain of arbitrary strength, they can't fuse because they would wind up out in some direction that's not in this set. So the only chains that can fuse now are ones that have the same strength. And that fusion is not efficient enough to suppress the infinite density of chains. Now we're getting back to Fred's question. In this case, you don't get an infinite force density, but you do get an infinite chain density. And when you try to compute the response function, things get very nasty. We haven't been able to sort that one out. Yeah.
Let's say there's something to be said for the discrete model over the continuous model, because you know, in 2D, the coordination at any site isn't going to be more than 6. Do you, if it's not consistent, have a problem with distribution that has positive values for more than several directions at one point, because it can't actually ever occur. And for that reason, using a 6-point model, there's a question of the angles shouldn't actually be fixed, but you shouldn't have more than...
Well, what you're saying is that...
...six different angles with discrete probability at one point.
What you're saying is that when I have a chain coming into here, there should only be a discrete set of directions that the chains can come out.
Yeah, you can't have more than 6 at a point.
Right, but so that would be... So when you write down the splitting function, what you're saying is that the splitting function at a given point corresponding to a chain coming in, like in this direction, should, you know, have some lobes to it or something like that. You know, there should be preferred angles here for the splitting. That's fine. We can put that in the splitting function. But that's not confining the chains to a particular set of directions. Because
it's not exactly the same, but the right. Basic result should be that there shouldn't be more than a few directions at any point.
Okay. Yeah, but a few directions at any point is very different from a few directions in the whole system.
Yeah, sure.
Well, yeah. I was going to say that an alternative to that is to just have a fully discrete set, but that's not fixed. Mm-hmm. Free rotate. Mm-hmm. That's isotropic. But in other words, at any given point, you just have a random choice of your six-fold coordination, and then you set.
No, I don't think you can get away with that because where does the chain that enters that point come from? It's got to come from a particular direction.
Well, but that factors in the probability of splitting.
there's a probability of
So you're saying that you want a chain coming here, and when it reaches here, there's, say, six directions it can go into, but maybe they're not lined up with this one. Is that what you mean?
No, well...
You could do that. You could have variables, so you only have six directions, but they were randomly determined, but look at the incoming one.
If you can solve that model, I would be completely thrilled. Right? Remember, the idea here is... The first idea was just to get to a point where we could actually solve a model so that we can understand it in all its detail, and then ask what features of the physics govern the solutions of that model. And by doing that, we discover things like you're not free to pick boundary conditions on the chains in the way that you might have thought. You're forced to do a two-point boundary value problem rather than a, even though the response is hyperbolic, you can't just fix everything at the top and propagate down. You're forced to do a two-point boundary value problem. You're forced to think of splitting as a very different process from fusing. You're forced to come to terms with the question of how the boundary conditions on the force chains determine directions. That's what we've learned so far. Now, in trying to generalize it in the various different directions, whether it's to more chain directions like this, or to a continuum set of directions, we're running into technical mathematical problems. But we hope that the physics that we learned from the solvable case is pointing us in the right direction. You know, there's, of course, always the big open question, too, which is whether modeling force chains directly is the right thing to do. But hopefully by studying the consequences of that assumption, we can learn a little bit more about how to focus on the crucial physical points associated with stress states in these dense, hard materials.
Welcome, questions, let's have a speaker.